Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Market Volatility Conference Call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mike Evans, Regional Vice President, Retail Sales. Please go ahead, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Lori, and good afternoon, everyone. You know, we know these are extremely challenging times and wanted to extend our appreciation for you to take the time to join us today and acknowledge that our thoughts are with you and your families and hope that you are all safe and healthy. You know, we've heard from you firsthand that you want timely information on market developments from your partners, and that's why we're here today. We recognize that you have many clients and prospects concerned about how recent events and market volatility have affected their investments and are impacting their futures. Each week, we've committed to bringing you relevant commentary during these calls from both an economic and a portfolio management perspective on current market developments. Today, you will hear from two senior members of Mackenzie's investment management team. With us are Paul Taylor. Paul is a Vice President, Investment Management, and joined Mackenzie's Multi-Asset Strategies team in October of 2019. He'll provide us with a macroeconomic perspective on Corona and the global fiscal, monetary, and social response to those events. Paul is a veteran PM and member of Mackenzie's Global Investment Committee, where he's quickly established himself as one of the firm's leaders shaping key investment strategies in relation to the current global health and economic crisis. Also with us this afternoon is Phil Toller, Senior Vice President, Head of Mackenzie's Growth Team. Phil is Lead Manager of Mackenzie's U.S. Mid-Cap Growth Class Fund, many of you know, and the newly launched Mackenzie Global Small Mid-Cap Fund. He has 29 years of investment experience and was named 2018's Fund Manager of the Year by the Investment Executive. He's going to share with us his U.S. equity perspectives. Just a quick note on today's call. Today's call is being recorded, and there will be a playback offered to all participants. We will have those sent out by your sales team afterwards. We will also be engaging in a Q&A at the end of the call. So as typical, we want to give you an opportunity to interact with our managers, ask questions, and get those questions answered. So we will have a moderated Q&A at the end. So, gentlemen, welcome.
Lots hey, Mike.
Hey, Paul, Phil. Lots to cover today.
Absolutely.
Probably the best place to begin would be on the macro side, Paul. So why don't we kick it off with you? I'll ask you one question. Is there any such thing as a normal day anymore? Like it seems when I last looked, we were up almost 2,000 on the Dow. So, you know.
Yeah, it looks like we're at the close now, up 2,100 on the Dow. So it's Mike, we've done a number of presentations over the last 3 weeks where, you know, we were close to double digits in the red. So it's kind of nice to have a day that's on the flip side of things. And maybe it's a good launching point because when I started to get ready for today, last night, I said, well, from a macro perspective, what I'll do is I'll take the tack, and that is finding a market bottom. What are the necessary conditions to actually find an equity market bottom? And that, you know, obviously very, very timely because a lot of folks, you know, would wonder with a day like this, you know, is this it or not? You know, we're reminded that back in October 2008, we thought we had a bottom, and then it was March of 2009 that we had that second bottom. So anyway, I thought from a macro perspective, three broad categories, you know, that would be the needed conditions to form a market bottom. And I'm going to start with, to me, the most obvious, but it is the most obvious, and that is that this is a health crisis. And so for us to have a market bottom, the equity market has to have the sense that we have managed containment of this incredibly significant health crisis that we're dealing with. And really what this is a crisis of confidence that our leaders are up to the task of containing, you know, this global health crisis. We know, I mean, I'm not going to go over all the steps that have been taken to deal with this thus far. Obviously, testing, We've seen a much better response after being, I would argue, a little slow out of the gate. The Trump administration, you know, came up with, I think, a very thoughtful public-private partnership to get testing, you know, across America and Walmart parking lots and things like that. Containment, obviously travel restrictions, and let's give Donald Trump credit. He did implement a very timely travel restriction to restrict those traveling from China to the U.S., more recently, obviously, to Europe and closing the north and south border. The shelter-in-place restrictions, the social distancing, all, to contain the spread, you know, given the virus is, you know, two things about it. One is it's versus the seasonal flu, which the transmission rate is something like 1.2%. You know, this is certainly north of that. In some cases, it's been north of 2%. The other is the fatality rate. I was looking at numbers this morning that to me are just stunning. And that is China's mortality rate is 4%, you know, of those affected. And actually Italy, in the report I have here in front of me, is actually listing 9.5%, which is why this is so alarming. So containment, treatment, you know, lots of work for folks to do, and a lot of flack from Andrew Cuomo to the federal government about the expansion of hospital capacity, and as well the sourcing of needed supplies and equipment. And then last but not least, you know, the therapeutic interventions that are being developed to address this. And then nirvana, of course, is vaccine. I think the one thing we would all be a bit critical of is the president's habit of promising, over-promising and under-delivering. And as it relates to vaccines, I think most people say it's wishful thinking to, you know, to see there be a vaccine anytime soon. So anyway, you know, the commentary around, you know, the experience that we've developed from just looking at it as a health crisis is the experience of leading coronavirus-affected countries is that aggressive social distancing works over a 6 to 8 week period. And that's critical, the 6 to 8 week period. Obviously, it's worked in China, South Korea, and Japan. Really interesting to see Italy over the last couple of days go from, the latest data is about 6,700 new cases per day to yesterday or the day before was south of 5,000 new cases a day. So this is really a litmus test, you know, of social distancing, you know, given how behind the curve Italy was and then how draconian authorities there have been. And to apply that to then to the U.S. The U.S. is past the early development phase. There are really four phases. And early development is the first. The second is acceleration. The third is late accumulation. And the last is then recovery. China, Korea are in the recovery phase. Italy is in the late accumulation, maybe in the late accumulation phase. The U.S. is going into the eye of the storm. And the concern is the market's not convinced that the Trump administration, you know, is getting ahead of this. And a lot of it, you know, given the decentralized nature of healthcare in the U.S. is being left to the governors. But what's really interesting from a health perspective to see is the attempt, or is the sense that there is potentially a policy adjustment coming. And by that I mean that, you know, you heard Donald Trump yesterday in front of the task force mention that a reopening of the U.S. economy is something that they're giving thought to, and whether this would be done on a state-by-state or regional basis, or some folks have commented that maybe they would, you know, if the issue is in older, in particular, males, that perhaps they would allow healthy workers, you know, maybe the cutoff is 25 to 54, that they would be allowed to go back working. But, you know, the sea change is that the concern is that there shouldn't be a complete shutdown of the U.S. economy, which is very different than what we faced in 2008-09. And that's something certainly the Global Investment Committee has talked about, and that is what makes this situation so difficult is that, you know, gauging the impact of a complete shutdown of the U.S. economy, and for that matter, the global economy, is just hard to gauge and very much, you know, unprecedented. Anyway, long and short of it is, you know, just to finish the health aspect of it, it is to reiterate that this is a health crisis. And the equity market will not bottom until it has a sense that there is a coherent plan to address this very significant health issue, and that we have at least a, you know, visibility on containment. That's the first thing. The second thing is policy response and mitigation of the impact. If we hadn't had any policy response, then there would be permanent damage. But I'm not going to go through all the monetary and fiscal policy response. The only comment I can make is obviously it's unprecedented. The monetary policy front, obviously lower administered interest rates across the world, QE infinity yesterday is pretty much what we got. The alphabet soup of programs and the money markets and commercial paper and mortgage-backed markets, et cetera, huge. The fiscal policy response, obviously a big part of what the markets are focused on today is Congress coming to terms on a fiscal stimulus plan, a $2 trillion plan. The key elements being, you know, on the business front, providing directed support to affected industries like the airline industry with, you know, some caveats, and with payroll tax payment delays, you know, for companies to encourage them not to lay off workers in 2020. And then on the individual front.
Just on that front, the $2 trillion package being proposed by the U.S., you know, that's 10% of GDP, some number in that range. Compare that to the $82 billion package in Canada. What are your feelings? Some people have been thinking maybe the Canadian government needs to do a little more.
Well, I think the Trudeau administration has said that this is an initial down payment, you know, on what needs to be done. You know, they have the initial $1 billion, which was really directed aid to address, you know, some of the provincial challenges that will come, you know, in terms of direct aid to hospitals and testing and things like that. And then the follow-on was the $82 billion, which was just voted on today, the Canadian Parliament. So, you know, just applying the rule, Mike, of, you know, 1 to 10, you know, you would think that there would be, you know, further follow-up. I think the area in particular on this side of the border that is glaring is again, help to businesses. You know, there are just so many, the whole service industry, be it, you know, restaurants, be it gyms, be it theaters, you know, these are businesses that right now have rent, you know, have loans. They've obviously laid off all their staff. But, you know, the key issue, and I'm glad you raised it, key issue as we go along is duration. You know, everything comes down to duration. You know, could we take, you know, a 4 week, you know, kind of time out, you know, to global economic activity? Yeah, but the pain would be massive. But if this lasts, you know, 8 weeks, or as Donald Trump, you know, originally mentioned that this could, you know, we could be dealing with this, you know, July, August, you know, that's just, you know, something, you know, in terms of order of magnitude, larger, you know, that is certainly something that, $82 billion to the Canadian side of the border would be insufficient when you add on the double whammy of oil prices imploding. So policy response, you know, the monetary policy response, the fiscal policy response. The policy response, you know, thus far is certainly, it's appropriate, but it's certainly insufficient by itself to provide the basis for a market bottom. But certainly policy response is one of the three necessary conditions for us to really say that there is a market bottom out there. And then the third, and this is certainly something that we as a global investment committee spent a lot of time on, in particular about a week back, is a well-functioning capital market. And, you know, it was very concerning to see the corporate credit market really, in terms of liquidity, yes, there were deals getting done, but the bid-off spread, you could drive a truck through. And that obviously caused, you know, some real troubles in terms of pricing of ETFs and things like that. But, you know, it was a market that was in a rudimentary way, you know, still functioning, but it certainly was of major concern. And so we certainly as a team, we said, look, you know, before we end up, you know, becoming more constructive on equities, you know, in terms of looking for a market bottom, we absolutely will want to look to the credit markets, you know, as a set of necessary conditions or a first indicator. Because if they're still seizing up, you know, there's absolutely no way that you want to be adding risk and taking a more risk on profile. So the Fed, let's give them credit. They've been successful in keeping kind of the plumbing working to minimize, you know, systemic risk. Certainly, you know, the Fed's QE infinity, which really, you know, I think the market was right to take, you know, that's what yesterday was. It certainly reduces, it doesn't eliminate, but it reduces, you know, the potential for systemic risk. And, you know, we're encouraged that, you know, policymakers, you know, principally the Fed, but really this has been coordinated, you know, across, you know, central banks globally, you know, that they, you know, we're encouraged that they've maintained the orderly functioning of the markets. And just this morning when our Global Investment Committee met, our fixed income guys were commenting on the fact that, spreads were getting a lot more orderly behavior in particular in both the investment grade and non-investment grade, markets. But, so that's a good thing. Anyway, so in summary, just from a macro perspective, you know, equity markets will bottom when visibility emerges that a coherent plan is in place to contain the spread of the virus. Again, we come back to it's, you have to state the most obvious, and that is they're not going to have bottom, you know, until this health crisis is seen to be, you know, contained. It doesn't mean we have to see the last person diagnosed, but we need to have the sense that there is a credible plan in place. The second is that we're taking appropriate monetary policy and fiscal policy steps to mitigate the impact of the virus. And I would give us a big check mark on that one. And then the third one, you know, the capital markets continue to function in an orderly fashion. So, you know, if the evidence from elsewhere is that it's about a 6 to 8 week period and we're, you know, well into a couple of weeks of full quarantine or close to full quarantine here in North America, you got to believe that, you know, 4 weeks out, you know, we'll have a much better sense for this. But so that's the macro. I just want to. My specific focus is on Mackenzie's Symmetry platform. And I did want to just quickly mention, you know, you go through periods like this and it's a litmus test for your portfolio construction methodology. And it's important for us to note that, you know, all five of our core Symmetry portfolios are performing in the top two quartiles on a 1 month, 1 year, 3 year and since inception basis. There's only one portfolio, I think our growth portfolios, it's in the 46th percentile on a 3 year basis. But otherwise, you know, we've had some relative positive outperformance and I think this does, you know, validate that our portfolio construction methodology on our multi-asset strategies team, you know, is well thought out. Yes, we did trail with Symmetry a bit, you know, in the straight up market in 2019. But, you know, the sources of added value that we can see very clearly because the team has done an excellent job of developing our performance attribution infrastructure is, you know, two things really, you know, that have quickly swung our relative performance. One is our active managers. Certainly, you know, we got a breadth of active managers, but, you know, our value factor bias in 2019 might have worked against us in a straight up market. It certainly has helped us of late. The second factor being our wider investment universe. Two things there. One is we can take some very granular investment views. And by that, we can look across the globe for opportunities and that creates performance opportunities. So, I mean, it might be, and I'm making this up now, it might be, you know, a bet on Korea through an ETF. It could be German bonds. The other is the inclusion of liquid alternatives, which, you know, we have in, for instance, our balanced portfolio, about 10% in liquid alts, which are great portfolio diversifiers, and that's helped scoot symmetry well on side. So Mackenzie, with our strong focus on portfolio construction, hopefully will continue to be there to lead us through these challenging times.
Mike, that's great, Paul. I appreciate your comments, both as it relates to the general economy and the state of things globally, as well as that linking back to your role on the Global Investment Committee and part of the multi-asset strategies team. No doubt we'll have some additional questions about impacts on symmetry, tilts that the KIC community has implemented when we dig into the Q&A. But thank you for setting the stage. I think you've done a really good job in helping us sort of frame where we are, where we need to go, more importantly, and how we're going to get there. Now we're going to shift gears. The PM component of today's call, Phil Taller, is with us. As I mentioned, Phil runs the U.S. Mid-Cap Growth Fund for us, a very well-known, widely held product across the country. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you to all of you for being with us.
Well, why don't I throw it over to you? Give us a rundown of what you've been up to, how things are going in the fund, your reaction to, perhaps preparation for, and your analysis in relation to the opportunities in the U.S. mid-cap space.
Okay. Well, apart from organizing my pocket squares in alphabetical order, you know, we've been spending a lot of time trying to talk to our companies about this, you know, the situation they find themselves in. You know, we as you know, we're a very company-focused team of investors, and so that's where we spend most of our time. I would point out, though, that, and I've been pointing this out to people in the last couple of weeks, is not that it matters right now, but if you do look back to the data that was coming out in January and February, and you look at some of the leading economic indicators, I've been pointing people, for example, to the Philadelphia Fed PMI. January and February was going up finally after some declines for a couple of years. Housing starts, you know, you look at that was very strong until recently. And yeah, admittedly, yes, all those things are off the table. They're all getting worse now. No question. But it does kind of point out to me that Fed fiscal policy still does work, you know, when the world is normalized. And who knows when that happens. But, you know, in a normal world, Fed fiscal policy still works. And it did start to help even the U.S. manufacturing economy, which had been in a bit of a recession in the last couple of years, especially 2019, had started to pick up. We were seeing that in statistics and hearing that from some of our companies. So, of course, that's off the table for now, but it was helping. And you've added some fuel to that. Obviously, you know, as Paul pointed out, there's a lot of stimulus in the pipeline that can't on its own make everything better. But certainly when things do start to look better on the healthcare front, there's a lot of fuel on the fire. So one thing I was struck in the last couple of weeks, I know this is kind of, I don't know, just sort of just being optimistic, but Matthew Siegel is one of the strategists I like hearing from at times, and he's with CLSA in Hong Kong. And he puts out all kinds of interesting charts, and one of the things he put out a couple of weeks ago is a chart of especially the U.S. equity markets during World War II. And what he points out there is that, you know, the market didn't bottom when the U.S. was winning the war. The market bottomed when they started seriously fighting. You know, it bottomed soon after Pearl Harbor. Then you had the Doolittle Raid and the battles of Midway and Coral Sea. And, you know, it's around that time, the Battle of Midway, when they start to seriously fight back, that's when the market bottomed. So I don't know if that has any relevance, but kind of gave me a bit of a good feeling somehow. I don't know why.
Well, it does seem like the world is collectively fighting back, right? Doing the right thing and mounting the right kind of response, both from government and socially. So, you know, that's encouraging.
Yeah, eventually it's easy to criticize politicians and business leaders, but, you know, ultimately, you know, we do pull together and get things together, and I think we will here too. One of the things, as I said, we're very company focused. So one of the things we really tried to focus a lot of our time on is talking to our companies. You can spend endless hours listening to doctors talk about this disease, and at some point it's worth doing, but only up to a point. So, you know, we think it's very important to talk to our businesses. We're trying to hear from a lot of them. We are stress testing and then stress testing again our models to see how our businesses can get through a tough time. We believe they can, but we keep talking to them and stress testing these things to see that they can get through it. One interesting example I've been pointing to of companies that we own that really, of course, all share prices are down, but interesting, some get tarred with a certain brush and, you know, have a hard time getting out from under it. But Gartner Research is interesting. Gartner Inc. is a company that stands out in our fund because it's our longest standing holding. We've owned Gartner for 12 years at various weightings, but we have owned it continuously, usually fairly significantly sized. Gartner, for those who don't know, it is a research company that provides research about technology mainly to people who purchase technology, although we are also customers because we like to learn about technology. But the vast majority of that revenue is delivered online. It's documents, webinars, phone calls. That is how most of the product is delivered and has been for many years. They do have 10% of their business is a conferences business and, you know, running events and summits, that kind of thing. As you can imagine, that's off the table for now. So that line is going away for this year mostly. And there are, you know, not only that, but there are fixed people costs. You don't take your conferences business and fire all the people because you know it's coming back. So you're absorbing cost as well. And, you know, the market is very focused on that. We've tried to, you know, go over it ourselves. I spoke to the company this morning, which is one reason I bring that one up, because we just talked to them. And, you know, we've factored that into our model. We think even if you took the events business, that conferences business away forever, the model would still give you lots of upside in this share price. They do have business interruption insurance, which, and we'll see how much they get out of that, but we think that might be significant dollars. And as with a lot of our companies, those who have some debt, we're going over with them what their debt covenants are and, where we think they can be on that. We're fairly confident that Gartner will not trip their debt covenants. They have proven in the past in tough times to be able to cut some costs in various ways. And, you know, it's a very high free cash flow generating business. It is mostly a subscription business, so people pay up front 12 months in advance. It's a high deferred revenue and therefore high free cash flow business. The core research business has a 70% gross margin. And, that's the vast majority of the business. And yet, you know, even with all those attributes, Gartner is down 40% this year. I think it's reflective of the fact that, you know, every business that has some headline connection to travel or conferences, or they have some debt on their balance sheet, is getting hit. And also the fact that, you know, when you have mass selling, when you have sort of ETF selling, when you have a lot of algorithmic selling of equities, the correlation between equities goes up. You've seen that very high, which, you know, given that we focus a lot more on the details of our companies, that creates a lot of opportunity. And so, you know, even as we stress test our models and take numbers lower for many of our companies, you're still seeing, you know, high double-digit discounts to the models, 20, 30, 40% discounts to a lot of our valuation models.
And Phil, I think it's all that work you do in understanding the companies, doing the analysis, updating your models, really getting into the granular nature of what makes these companies tick and what they're really worth. It gives you the comfort to weather a storm like this and not worry that price is somehow reflective of an accurate gauge. Talking about the individual names in the portfolio, I think is a great way to sort of represent what's going on with the fund. And no doubt, I would, you know, some of the questions we've been getting are around, has this market created some opportunities that you're taking advantage of? And because you're so well-versed in the modeling of your companies, it's made you comfortable in holding names like Spirit Airlines, for example, or Progressive. Maybe those are two ideas we could discuss at more length.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've added to some names. We've added to Gartner in the last couple of months. We've added back a couple of companies, not in huge ratings, but a couple of companies that we have owned in the past where the share price got pretty beat up, and, you know, companies where we think that, you know, they have pretty good business models even in this world. One of them is a healthcare data analytics business that we've owned previously, that we think should hold up reasonably well. But yeah, no, there's, you know, you run the gamut. It's an interesting barbell set of examples. So Spirit Airlines would be one of the ones that has obviously been kind of completely trashed in the marketplace, even though it was up 38% today. It's still down over 60% this year.
Wow.
And understandably, you know, it's an airline, so we get it. You know, I'm, you know, we saw a price quoted today. I don't know if anyone actually would go anywhere, but, you know, there are flights available for $19 within the U.S. on Spirit. So, you know, we had dinner almost 3 weeks ago with the CEO of Spirit. And so, you know, up to a few weeks ago, we could actually meet our company. So we did it. We did sit down with the CEO at Spirit, and, you know, they had $1 billion of cash on the balance sheet, which is one of the higher levels of cash relative to size among the airlines. They do have the ability to park a fairly big percentage of their fleet because they own a good chunk of their airplane fleet. I would point out that, you know, obviously, although they will take a massive revenue hit, we've modeled that in for this year. We're modeling a very big hit and still believe they can get through that and not, probably not chew through all of their cash. They do need 2021 to be a better year, that's for sure.
They had a fairly sizable war chest, did they not? Some large amount of money on the balance sheet.
Yeah, with $1 billion on the balance sheet, and you know, the capacity to cut a lot of costs, especially, you know, capital spending can be cut. The other thing you know, the biggest expense item on their income statement is fuel. And, you know, of course, two things are going to just cut that to very little. One thing is the fact that you're not flying. And when you do fly this year, your jet fuel cost is much lower per gallon than it was last year. So that massive expense line for jet fuel is going to come way, way down. So there's a lot of stuff that's variable cost there. So, you know, having been through it with them, we think they can certainly make it through a pretty tough year. They have the lowest cost per available seat mile in the business. And if anybody makes it, we think they can. That's one extreme in the fund of somebody that the market really feels is very threatened. The other extreme you might go to is Progressive that you mentioned, which is close to a 6% weighting here. So it's our biggest holding. Progressive shares are only down 2% this year. And probably rightly so. Progressive is, apart from being a wonderfully well-managed company, as a property and casualty insurer, mostly involved in automotive, there's a good chance that their earnings actually might go up this year. I'm not sure they're going to write quite as many policies as they would have before. But at the same time, we think, the vast majority of people probably don't give up their automobile. And therefore, as you saw in the last Great Recession, people do keep their cars. They tend to pay the premium. And given that there's so few people on the road for some period of time here, accident frequency probably goes down, which might actually increase Progressive earnings for a time. So it's holding up quite well. So, every business we own has its unique characteristics, and we're just trying to go through each one, think about, how tough can things get. Can they make it through that? And then talking to them about how they do that, how they operate here. That, I think, is, as we talk to companies or hear from their customers, it is clear that, this situation has kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room. There's not a ton of long-term planning here. I think everybody is focused on how do they operate right now, right here. How do we get stuff done? And that's where everybody's focused.
Phil, are there any holdings in your portfolio that you're really worried about that you're representing concerns related to how deep and long this event lasts?
Yeah, I think that although it is a very small weighting, I do think that we own a small piece of Dave & Buster's, and for those who don't know, Dave & Buster's is a restaurant company, but as luck would have it, or unfortunately, their business model is kind of food and beverage, but also entertainment. So when you go to a Dave & Buster's, you might do one of two things. One is you might watch sports in their sports bar area, which not a lot of that is happening. And the other thing is you play games. So they have a big game area. It's partly video games, active games, physical games, virtual reality games, all of which is kind of fun, but clearly nobody's going there. Even if they were allowed to, they probably wouldn't go. So there's a period of time here where for many of their restaurants, they're just closed. And that's a tough one. You still got to pay rent. You still got to keep some people on staff. So we do believe of all our companies, they are probably the most likely to trip their debt covenants. We think that in this world, it's very unlikely that bank lenders are going to get aggressive about this kind of stuff here because, you know, I think they realize that the world, you know, this is an extreme situation, but not likely to last forever. So we doubt that they, you know, demand the loans, but we do think Dave & Buster's is probably in a pretty tough spot. The positive on the other side is one of the things that has Dave & Buster's has been dealing with the last couple of years is a lot of increased new entrants, competition, very small companies, but companies coming up with various eating / entertainment locations. Probably a lot of those companies lack scale, operational ability, planning ability. Dave & Buster's has been around a long time. And one thing we know for sure from talking to ex-employees and people who have observed them is that they are great operators. And so we do think that, you know, quite likely this really tough situation probably puts some of the smaller competitors out of business. Wouldn't surprise us. So if these guys can get through this, there might be a better world ahead. The other thing
gives them a chance to pick up. Yeah, it gives them a chance to pick up market share.
Yeah, we think there'd probably be less competition. And we would point out that in the last few months, we've been joined by KKR as a shareholder. KKR has picked up 12% of this company. And we've spoken to them about what they see as their vision for the business and, you know, the things they think could be improved. So you have one of the biggest private equity companies in the world as a fairly large shareholder now, bigger than we are, and certainly very interested in making sure they revive and prosper.
Great. So that leads to sort of two additional questions I'll ask you. That one, a lot of folks are interested in your cash weights, how much, you know, money do you have on the sidelines, and are you putting that to work? And then you and I spoke prior to the call about your work with your discounted cash flow models, how you sort of built in, not knowing anything about Corona, obviously, but sort of built in a recession expectation in 2019 and then revised that forward. How even your conservative modeling, how does the portfolio look from a value perspective today in relation to sort of the target price you put on the assets in the portfolio?
You're right. We, as we entered 19, we started to assume a recession in that year. That obviously didn't happen, so we just carried it forward into 2020. So anything we owned, even, you know, before this started, before everything went pear-shaped, we were already assuming a garden variety recession for this year. So we felt that was reasonable. I think it's a fair point to say that for some of these companies, it's going to be worse than a typical recession. At least, you know, hard to fathom exactly because it depends how bad is Q2, possibly Q3, how much of a recovery do you get in Q4. It's a tough one, but it could be worse than we originally modeled. But we still felt that, you know, those prices were fairly reasonable, and most of our models aren't getting even when we do the stress test of a much worse year, given that these companies are going to recover, given that the models value many, many years of cash flows to come, not just this year, the models are going down a bit, but not a ton. So the share prices are very attractive. Almost across the board, we're seeing very attractive valuations here. Which is why, you know, we don't have a lot of cash. You know, you asked about cash. I think the headline cash number would be about 3%. We are going to receive the proceeds soon for a software company we own, which has now been taken over. So there's another percent of cash that'll be coming into the fund fairly soon. So effectively, it's about 4%. But you know, I think at these valuation levels, having a ton of cash doesn't make too much sense to us here. Because you don't know when a day like today happens. And I'm not saying that tomorrow the market won't be down 10%. That's altogether possible. But you also don't know where the bottom is. None of us knows when that happens exactly. And, you know, at these valuation levels, you don't want to be, you know, just uninvested.
Agreed. Question that we have been getting a lot. I want to make sure we get it before, and then we should probably throw it open to two questions from the line. But been getting a lot of questions around currency and your impression. You've got two versions of the fund, the currency neutral and an unhedged version. Your call on currency, you've been fairly forthcoming in years past as to, you know, where you would tend to position. What are your thoughts there?
So I think the U.S. dollar is doing the job it's supposed to do for us as usual. So I know this feels painful anyway, but in a crisis situation, the U.S. dollar tends to be your friend. It has done that again this year. It's up about 11-ish percent relative to the Canadian dollar. So things would be, not that we're all happy, but things would be a lot worse without the U.S. dollar having helped us out a bit. That's the thing it does short-term. Long-term, what the U.S. dollar has done for the core version of the fund compared to the currency-neutral version is lowered volatility. So that's a long-term thing the U.S. dollar does. We do, at times, though, we hedge. And, you know, what I've said to people over the last several years is the times that we tend to hedge are when people are very fearful, when there's a lot of pessimism, when global growth looks horrible, when the Canadian dollar has gotten crushed. That's when we think hedging is worth considering. So, you know, it's a fair point to say that what I just, you know, what I do, all those conditions that I just pointed out, I think we can tell.
Are right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. Thank you for your comments there. Why don't we, Lori, why don't we throw it open to questions from the line? I know there's a number of people on the line that want to ask both Phil and Paul questions that
sure.
are on their minds.
Certainly, Mr. Evans. We'll now take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register for questions. Thank you for your patience. And Mr. Evans, if you could speak for a couple of minutes just to give us some time to transcribe these lines. We have several questions coming up.
Absolutely. Perfect. Phil, I'll give you one quick one. We talked about market beta and adding or detracting from sort of some of the cyclicality. What would you be looking for in way of economic developments to add more beta to the portfolio?
I think that's definitely the thing to consider doing, because I do think, you know, we've had you know, January, February, I think, you know, what you had was some kindling, you had some paper, you were starting to light a match, and that's, you know, the fire's gone out a bit, but now you've gone and basically poured a bunch of kerosene on there as well, and we may not have a match yet, but when it lights, I do think there's a pretty massive snapback you can see. I don't know when that is. But I do think, you know, we're definitely trying to keep our thoughts open to the idea that when you do add some things again or you know, start shifting the portfolio, maybe you shift out of a progressive, which is much more conservative, and into something that's a little more cyclically exposed or, you know, more growthy, that kind of thing.
Perfect. Lori?
Yes.
Any questions from the line?
We do. The first question is from Elizabeth Lowry from Scotia Wealth. Please go ahead.
Hi. This is probably directed at Paul, and it may not be a question you can answer, but have you modeled where your what kind of earnings you're looking for the S&P 500 going forward and what kind of multiple you would put on it?
Well, Lori, you know, a couple of comments there. The answer is no, because it's just things are moving so quickly. I can tell you I've seen a couple of pretty coherent, you know, views and trying to pinpoint, you know, what a reasonable bottom would be. And so somebody came up with a bottom of 2,100 on the S&P 500. And as I recall, that used about a $139 earnings. And there was some logic that went into it. So, you know, whatever the multiple, you know, associated with that, that would be. But, you know, on 165 from 2019, expectations that we were, well, maybe 167, 168, going to 175, which was the market expectation 2019 to 2020. And then the adjustment, you know, given that, you know, earnings are going to be very materially affected in Q1 and certainly, you know, for the first part of Q2, but then they'll snap back sharply in Q3, Q4. But that was trying to, you know, to take, you know, kind of a worst case scenario. But at this point, really we're guessing because of this, you know, we come back to duration. You know, is this, does this last 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks? You know, the only thing I would say, you know, Phil talked about, you know, some of the opportunities in the, you know, U.S. mid-cap space and, you know, really good, I think, for him to bring to life, you know, some of those business-specific opportunities. But, you know, there certainly is some incredible value out there in the marketplace. And, that's the way I would deal with it.
I'm guessing with Phil's mid-cap, they didn't do a lot of share buybacks, I'm hoping. Maybe Progressive, but the other question I really ask is, where are earnings without share buybacks on the S&P 500?
I don't think
the mid-cap does a lot of share buybacks, do they?
I think you'll find most people did.
Okay.
That does lead to an interesting question, though, Elizabeth. I like it. Phil, you've had a lot of takeouts in the portfolio in the last few years. Does this dramatic price reset create some opportunities / threats of some of your companies being taken out at much lower prices?
I doubt it. I certainly can't see any management team, unless they're in deep distress and just cannot function, I can't see many management teams wanting to sell their business at these prices, and I can't see most shareholders wanting to approve that. So I really doubt there'll be any M&A action or deals going on this year.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth, for your question. Lori? Additional questions from the line?
Yes. The next question is from Brandon Brisbois. Please go ahead.
I just wanted to go back to Spirit Airlines whenever you were talking about the specific holding. I'm just wondering how or if you factored in the potential airline bailout that's being negotiated right now or how you think that could play out for them.
So we're not assuming that. We're trying to be, you know, cautious. So we're not going to assume that anybody provides any help. So our, just to give you a sense, and this may be very extreme, but, you know, in our model right now, we're modeling a 40% revenue decline for Spirit. Nobody's making that kind of assumption. We're just carrying it to be, I don't know if you want to call it extreme, but we're trying to stress test the model with no government help, pretty horrific revenue decline, some expense savings as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, even with that, you know, they still have some cash coming into 2021. So that's the thinking there.
Thanks, Brandon.
Okay, see you soon. Yep.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. The next question is from Sean Klotz. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mike. Hi, everyone.
Hey,
just
hey, Sean.
Just a question. So some clients have been asking me, they're sitting with some cash, and they're wondering what's the best way to enter into the market with these funds. Maybe I'd throw that out to you, and you could answer that.
Sorry, I was on mute. So, sorry, you said the client has cash. I mean,
yeah. So I guess the question I get asked is, you know, now is this a good? Obviously, the market valuations are down, and they're sitting with some cash, and they're saying, you know, what's the best way to re-enter this type of market? And they're already existing Mackenzie investors. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Just, guys, before we throw it over to you, based on opportunity, a terrific way to take advantage of that is, of course, dollar cost averaging, right? We have versions of DCA versions of all of our funds where, in essence, you buy a money market product, and then on a 1/52nd per week basis, you're dollar cost averaging back into the main fund. So that could be Phil's fund or any of the symmetry products, global dividend, anything that you're looking at. So, you know, I think it's extremely difficult to try and time a bottom, as both you know, Paul mentioned. Taking advantage of these better prices gives people an opportunity to get in now and take advantage of cheaper in future, or at least get a foothold and begin that process of reinvestment.
Yeah. Okay.
What would you say, Paul? Anything different?
Yeah.
Trying to time the market, it really is tricky.
Well, I have a real life situation, and that is, you know, we have my mother. Who is not young, so she's in her mid-80s, and she fortunately, just by dumb luck, she ended up with money in cash. About 40% of her money was in cash. It was actually stuck in limbo between two brokerage firms. And so we, a couple of weeks ago, we had the decision as to whether, you know, to hang on to that cash or not. And so we did deploy, you know, money into the market. But I think, Mike, I think your comment about, I mean, ideally what you do is, you know, if you have someone who has this fortunate situation where they have cash, as long as they have, you know, a sufficient time horizon, you know, for them to say, okay, you know, let's put some money to work now. And, you know, you hold back some money you know, you expect the best, plan for the worst. You put, maybe you put 50-60% of that money to work and give it to guys like Phil, you know, to look for opportunities in the marketplace and hold some of that money back and yourself kind of dollar cost average in. But Phil, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's plausible. I mean, talking to advisors over the years, one thing that's become very clear is people, nobody likes buying something and then it's down 10% the next week. So, yeah, often, sure, you know, sort of easing your way into something, you know, tends to be the most prudent way to do these things. Cause I know a lot of clients get kind of exercised when things go down immediately, which they have a tendency to do in these kinds of markets.
Fair enough. What do you think the recovery is going to look like?
V-shape, U-shape, you mean? Like elongated or fairly sharp? Is that what you're thinking, John? Sean? John?
I'm asking.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll pipe it. I think it's different for every business. I'm not a big macro thinker. Maybe Paul can provide some broader stuff. But, you know, like a Gartner, for example, where the actual revenue decline, I don't think is going to be that massive, and therefore, you know, the recovery is going to be pretty okay, but, you know, not that radical. On the other hand, you know, we own small but not not tiniest weighting in a company like Middleby, which makes food service equipment for restaurants. That business is not going to zero because there are things that still need to be prepared in places like hospitals and military kitchens, that kind of thing. But, you know, restaurant equipment operators, you know, that's a pretty tough market these days. That could be a massive recovery because, you know, orders go to zero for a period. I shouldn't say zero, but they get crushed. And then all of a sudden people are back online and the fryer doesn't work and you can't have that. So that kind of business, the recovery is very sharp.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Hey, John, I appreciate the questions, both very good and pointed, and probably not a bad way to shut things off. There we are right on the hour. Gentlemen, it seemed to fly by. I really appreciate you spending the time with us. Just in way of summarizing, you know, we recognize that you're fielding lots of calls from your clients and investors, both concerned about the downside and wanting to participate in the up and putting the money in the right places. And it's our goal to keep you informed with calls like this, and we've committed to doing this on a weekly basis for the foreseeable future. We urge you to reach out to your McKenzie sales team. They're going to be reaching out to you, but if you have any additional questions after today's call, please do so, and we'll relay those back to Paul and Phil and get you some answers if we didn't address them on the call. We'd also urge you to go to the McKenzie website to access some of the resources we've established there. We've got a COVID-19 component to our advisor site with manager commentaries and additional resources that we've dedicated to giving you information regarding Corona and the products and services that we offer. These are indeed extraordinary times, and we're going to get through it together. We wish you and your families a safe and healthy future, and we thank you for joining us on today's call. Thanks, guys.